we're still so young. Why the hell are we complaining this much about work? We still have to continue working for at least 40 years.
Welcome to the Inner Podcast. My name is Khalil, head of Espas Lab. I'm very, very excited today to introduce to you Pim de Murray, co-founder of Corporate Rebels. Dear Pim, thanks for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
You did study industrial engineering and management science in Eindhoven. You spent a year in Spain, then returned and did your master in science in innovation management, which is good in our topic, I guess. Finishing university, you joined Vanderland Industries. And what I found out is that you work on sales of service contracts of airport baggage handling systems worldwide for about 2.5 years. And back in 2016, your partner, Joost, and both of you, you quitted your corporate jobs. You started to travel around, find the most inspiring workplaces. What you learned during this journey, you shared on a blog, and you published a book, and where you shared your insights from this journey. And today, as Corporate Rebels, you support, inspire, and push companies, that's what you write, to develop a more progressive organization. And probably the one first question, what is the most painful corporate work story you did ever hear from, or probably you experienced yourself?
Where to begin? I have a couple of them myself, and maybe we'll talk about those later, but when that really is way more painful than what I've ever experienced is something that happened a couple of months ago when the corona crisis first hit and a lot of companies had financial trouble. So one of them was a electric scooter company based in Silicon Valley. Bird, they are called. You know them?
Yeah.
This story about them is not so nice. So they had to let go, or they decided to let go of 30% of their staff. And without taking the time to properly tell them that 30% of their workforce was laid off, they scheduled a Zoom meeting for 30 minutes. People had no clue what the Zoom call was going to be about. Some got an invite, others not. So there was obviously a lot of gossip and guessing, like, what is this going to be about? So the fear was already well established. And then they went into this call. The call took in total 120 seconds. And that was the way the company decided to let people go. So in 120 seconds, somebody who was not the CEO or not in the leadership team of the company then announced through a script that 30% of the people were let go. So this is so, when I heard this story and when I researched this story for a piece I wrote on our blog, it just shows once again that some organizations around the world are doing such a poor job in treating people as human beings. And this is exactly what we're fighting against at Corporate Rebels. And we believe that more organizations should take care much more of their people in a better way. And stories like this show that we, in some companies for sure, have a long way to go.
Probably, let's start with your personal experiences. Why did you, why did your partner, Joost's name, why did you guys quit your job?
We quit our jobs because of the frustration that we experienced ourselves. So as you mentioned, I worked for about 2.5 years for a company called Vanderland, and they make baggage handling systems for airports, among others. I did exactly what I studied for. So the study perfectly fit with what I wanted to do. And I started to work for the company, very excited. And over a period of 2.5 years, slowly but surely, I became terribly disengaged. So I wasn't happy with the workplace itself. I was actually very happy about the work, but not the way the company was structured and the way the work was organized. So for example, the fact that there was a boss who was telling me exactly what to do. There were lots of rules that were dictating exactly how a certain job should be done. So there wasn't any room for creativity or entrepreneurship or initiative. You just simply had to follow the rules. And there wasn't any freedom. So you had to come into the office from 9 to 5 and that's it. So for me, this was really a disappointing experience because I liked the work itself, but this childish environment, I couldn't really be a part of that. I didn't want to be a part of that. So after a couple of years, I sat down with a good friend of mine, Joost, and we started to discuss this, and he experienced the exact same thing. You worked for a big...
Where? Yeah, where
for a big German company called Henkel. And he experienced the same thing. And he's much more of a nerd. So he studied nanotechnology. And he worked in a lab in Barcelona, also really enjoying the work and, of course, the lifestyle in Barcelona. But the way the company was organized was way worse than the company I worked at. So the German hierarchy, but a lot of secrecy in the organization, a lot of elements that he also disliked very much. So we got together when I was visiting him in Barcelona, and we talked about this, and we were just for an hour or even more complaining about our work. And then we reflected, like, we're still so young. Why the hell are we complaining this much about work? We still have to continue working for at least 40 years. So should we maybe change something about it, or try to change something about it? And that's when, after a couple of beers, we decided to start Corporate Rebels, to start looking for alternative ways of organizing work.
May I ask you something? Why did you guys decide to quit and not to, you know, to step up inside your organization and hack the organization and to discuss with management and try to change the organization internally?
Yeah, good question. The main answer is that we simply didn't know how. So I wanted to change a lot of things. And some of my colleagues I worked with also wanted to change a lot of things. And we tried some things. So we set up a what's it called in English? Like a society for the young people working in the company to come together on social events, to learn together, to get inspired by various speakers, etc. So we tried to do some small things, but I really didn't know how to do it on a more important scale. So, for example, how can you change decision making? How can you create more freedom in your organization? All of these things, I didn't really know how to do it. And I had read some books, but that don't tell you at all how it actually should be done. So out of that curiosity, it was actually born. So ideally, you would indeed want to try and change it from the inside out. But we really had no clue. So we started, first of all, to learn from the pioneers around the world.
As I mentioned, you did study innovation management. Didn't you get any hints from the studying or from the university? And probably also afterwards in discussion with professors and to ask them, hey guys, I'm here in the middle of a mess. Can you help me out?
No, not at all. So what I learned during my university degrees, both in my bachelor and my master's degree, was the fact that everything we learned there was super traditional. So you learn about traditional hierarchies. You learn about stage gate processes to innovate. You learn about creating efficiencies by optimizing processes and by kind of dehumanizing the workplace instead of humanizing it. So it was kind of, we learned about the whole history of management. So you learn about Frederick Taylor and the whole movement. He started kind of in the Industrial Revolution to split the thinking and the doing in work and then focus on optimizing every single part of the doing so you become more and more efficient, which worked perfectly back then when everything was exactly the same every single day. But nowadays it doesn't work anymore, but we still studied more or less all of those exact topics. So it wasn't about how can you create organizations where people are free to make their own decisions. How can you motivate staff so they feel they contribute to something meaningful that they truly believe in? These questions were never asked. So I even though I thought I would be studying that topic, I really wasn't. So we were really learning the dark side, so to speak, or the traditional side.
As I mentioned, you started to travel around. You saved money and then you started to travel around to look out for organizations, to find them who works differently, who, like you just described, really humanize work and where it's probably fun actually to work at. How did it go? How did you find these organizations?
So we started, I think, with a list, a bucket list that we call it, of pioneers around the world that we wanted to learn from. And the easiest things to do was coming out of the books we had read. So for me, it started with a documentary and a book about Ricardo Semler and Semco, a Brazilian company that he has already transformed since the 80s into a workplace where people select their own managers, set their own salaries and their working hours. So really radical company that especially here in Holland is quite a well-known example. So we were inspired by that at first. And we started to read about Google and Spotify and what those companies were doing. And then slowly but surely, once you get into one book, you learn about another organization. And all of the ones that we thought were interesting to research, we added to that bucket list. We put it up on a website and said to everyone who wanted to hear, these are the ones we're going to visit. If you have any other ideas for people and organizations we should learn from, let us know and we might add them to that list. So nowadays we have more than 200 companies and people on that list. And it continues to expand. So every time we learn about more interesting examples that we want to study in detail and actually visit ourselves, then we add it to the list and we try to go there as soon as possible.
Probably just of curiosity, which companies in Switzerland did you already visit?
One that we also talk about in our book, Haufe Umantis, HR tech company based in St. Gallen. And they're quite weird company as well, super radical in some elements. So they have this practice of selecting their own or electing their leadership positions in the company, all the way up to the CEO. Every year they have leadership elections for all of the positions. So you need a certain approval rate, even the CEO, to stay in that position. So it's quite radical. It's what they call a democratic company. So they looked at the governmental model of Switzerland and they said, how can we make companies also more democratic instead of dictatorial as they are mostly?
Probably do you have a few, one or two other examples from company which you visited and you were really impressed by, no matter if they're in Switzerland or somewhere else in the world?
Yeah, so I think the beauty of the various organizations that we visited is that it's not, like a lot of people have the prejudice that it works, like progressive ways of working only work in startup internet companies. So tech companies based in Silicon Valley. I can tell you the most interesting examples are not the ones in Silicon Valley. So we went to Google, big disappointment. We visited Spotify, they're interesting, but not the most progressive ones that we visited. But if you look at it, like we've been to production companies, like a really interesting example is a large company called Haier. They produce refrigerators and washing machines. So diehard manufacturing company. And they are working in a super radical way where they split up the big company with 80,000 employees into more than 4,000 small companies where everybody can be an entrepreneur, can select their own leader, set their own working hours. So also a really radical company in a place you wouldn't expect it. Another organization that really inspired me was the Belgian Ministry of Social Security. So a governmental organization.
Okay.
Yeah, that's surprising, right?
That's really surprising, yeah.
And the people that work there, they can set their own working hours. They can decide even how many hours a week they want to work. They're experimenting with 300 people to work in a self-managing kind of way. So it's really interesting to see what can happen in even the most unlikely places.
If you would have to, you know, probably summarize three learnings out of this journey you made so far, what these three learnings would be?
I think what is one of the most important lessons that we learned, like we set out to find the magic solution or the silver bullet. So what is the solution to create engaging, motivating workplaces? And after a couple of months, we figured out that that's not possible. So there is not one single solution. We love to talk, a lot of companies love to talk about agile. They love to talk about new work or self-management or, but there's so much variety and we should understand that there is not a single solution. It's about, thinking about the principles that you want to, use for the way you organize yourself. And then thinking about what kind of experiments can we set up to change the way that we work. And for every company, this will be different. Even within a company, there might be differences in how certain departments, for example, pick this up. So forget about taking an off-the-shelf solution like Holacracy or Agile, where you simply ask a couple of consultants to train you in this certain way of working. Don't think that that will create a great place to work. It's much more about listening to people in your organization, figuring out where work sucks for them and where work is already great that you can amplify. And then set up experiments to make it even better and listen to what people, especially those at the front line, need in order to do the best possible job they can. So this is one main lesson that a lot of companies are overlooking because it's easier to look at a certain set solution that they can implement instead of really going the hard way and the hard route to figure it out for themselves. I think this is one of the main lessons in that there's not one model that you can copy paste. Another important lesson is that it can work anywhere, as I already briefly mentioned. Like, it doesn't have to be a young company or a young IT company to do stuff like this. It can work in production setting. It can work in China. It can work in South America, in North America. It can work everywhere as long as you're sincere about actually putting it into practice and really trying to make your work more about the people that are in the company. So that's another important one. Third important lesson is that you are, and this is also something that we learned during the trip, you'll never get there. So we talk about progressive workplaces, but all of them have big struggles for themselves. So for example, the Swiss company I mentioned, they're now struggling with this concept of electing their leadership positions every year. And they're rethinking, how can we do it better? How can we change it? So there's not an end state that you can get to. It's always thinking about, okay, what is it now? What problem do we have to solve now that we can do better next year? And this sounds maybe a bit disappointing and maybe not something that a lot of people want to hear, but it's the fact that like even those companies that sound almost utopian still have a lot of trouble that they have to solve. So I think that's that realistic aspect is important for people to understand too.
Probably when we go to the next place, you already mentioned a few things, how to become a more progressive, more humanized organization. What I could imagine, or my hypothesis, that it won't start, this process will not start if probably the board, the senior management is not willing to do that. From your experiences, from your discussions with the organizations from the bucket list, what made the senior management, the board, what made them to take this quite risky step to change the system?
So mostly it starts with leadership. There are alternatives as well, which might be interesting to talk about a little later. But so if mostly the change is initiated by the leaders in the company. So sometimes that's because the leader had a very strong life-changing experience his or herself. So for example, we went to a company where the leader of the company and the owner of the company went into rehab because it was addicted to drugs and to alcohol and really had to step away from the organization for a certain period of time. And when he came back from rehab, he was, of course, worried about how the organization was doing. And they had actually the best couple of months that the organization ever had. So for him, this was on one hand a relief, but also quite painful because apparently when he was there, they were doing a poorer job than when he wasn't there. So this was for him a clear insight that he needed to change something about his leadership style because he actually was getting in the way of doing good business. Others are maybe more rebellious from the start already. So they've maybe been educated or born even a certain way. And they believe that people are essentially good, and they also want their workplaces to show this, that it should be about trust and not about distrust, or that it should be about freedom and not about control. So they
how do they get to this thought?
I don't know. I think it can be part of first of all, it can be part of how you're born, but also how you're raised. So I can imagine if your people or if your parents give you a lot of freedom, and you figure out that freedom is very nice to have, and then all of a sudden you come into this controlling environment that you really feel is toxic, then I can imagine that you kind of have been educated this specific way. So that also happens quite a lot. And for some leaders, it's simply the only way they see to actually save the company. So there's quite a lot of these organizations that transform into this more progressive way of working in a time of crisis, where they see almost no other alternative than to really start rethinking the way they do business. So that also, a crisis can definitely be good for that, to open people's eyes and to really make them rethink how they are working.
From your point of view, let's take a Swiss company, probably in the area of logistics, for about 50,000 employees, and a very, very successful and long history for more than 150 years. How's...
And you probably can name them, right?
I probably can. How can an organization like that, the management or the employees, how can they recognize that they really need to change to a more progressive organization?
I think for many companies, it's good to understand that what is it that the people in our organization would like to see different? And then especially looking at the people that are closest to customers. Like, what do they need to do their job in a better way? This is a super important question. Like, if you ask this question a lot, which these progressive organizations do, you figure out how to do your job in a better way. If you simply ask frontline staff, okay, what do you need from us to do a better job? What barriers do we need to get rid of? Are there too many rules you have to listen to? Can we maybe get rid of some of them? Do you need more support from us instead of direction? There can be a lot of things that you maybe never talk about, but that are very powerful to start with. And I think the conversation should always start with this. And then it's about leadership to support the frontline staff as much as possible in what it is that they need, and then slowly start setting up experiments to change the way that they work. I think this is important to understand, because for senior leadership, or for everyone working in the company who is really believing in what the company is doing, creating such a more progressive workplace leads to a lot of benefits. It's not just a more fun or enjoyable workplace for the people working in the organization. It also leads to better results. So if people are more engaged, they perform better. If companies are more engaging in how they run their business, they are more productive, they are more profitable. There's enough research showing this, these outcomes. So it's about finding a way to actually unleash all of that talent that you have in an organization that might be bound currently by lots of rules and restrictions and control mechanisms. So having this conversation, like, the people at the top need to be convinced that this more free, more liberated way of working is not just good for the people, but also good for the organization. And if they understand that, it's about trying to change things. And in a company with such a long history, with so many people, you shouldn't start changing the entire organization at once. That's way too risky. And you risk your entire business because you have no clue up front what's going to work and what's not going to work. So it's about finding the people in your organization, maybe a couple of teams or a couple of departments that are eager to change, that want to be more or less the pioneers in the organization, that want to experiment. And if you can find a couple of those departments or a couple of those teams, and you give them the opportunity to redesign their own workplace, and you can show that it works and figure out what actually works for your company, and then you can try to scale it to other departments. Because it's way too risky to do it all at once. So contain the risk to a small part of the organization, figure out what works, and then try to draw more people into this change.
Do you know any company who started this kind of journey? No, by taking step by step, starting small with small single teams or departments?
Yeah, one of the most beautiful examples is this Chinese company I mentioned, Hire. So they are constantly doing this, always looking for new ways of working based on what the most progressive teams want to try. And they took over part of General Electric in the US a couple of years ago, and they're now also changing that organization from the inside out. But they're not forcing anybody in that company to change. They're just inviting people to look at their model, what they have in China, and to invite them, if you want to try this too, then we are here to support you to make such transformation happen. And then they start with some teams, and now they're adding departments to it. And now, after a certain period of time, and results are already there, but after a certain period of time, they start to make the bigger changes. So they don't start to change with the organizational structure at first. They make smaller decisions first, smaller experiments first. And if they see that that works, they try to grow the impact of what they're doing. Once again, to keep the risk to a minimum and to make sure the change is led by the people who need to change and not by an outside or external force. Because when you're forced to change, all of a sudden all the fun is out of it. It's much more fun to change for yourself because you want to, instead of being forced to make a change.
The basic reason why people should or needs to be in charge of this changing process and having fun along the journey is that they realize by themselves that they cannot continue the daily business as it happens because they're just simply not happy. Is that right?
Yeah. Like that's one part of it. I think it's a good starting point. Like if we work with companies to help them to change or give them insights to change, there's nobody ever who doesn't want to change. If you talk about creating a more human workplace, like fun, we use the word a lot because it's simple to understand, but it's also a bit of an exaggeration. Like we're not talking about, we don't like to really focus on fun as in, a lot of startup companies try to do. They give free beers on Friday afternoon. They throw in foosball tables and beanbags, and they think that then they create a great place to work. But it's about much more than that. It's about how can you change decision making? How can you give people meaning in their job? How can you give them autonomy? These are the real things that make work engaging. So it's about having a talk with the people to understand what is it that you want. And there's almost nobody who then says, I don't want that. I don't want a more human workplace. I don't want to have more decision-making power. I don't want to have more freedom. So it's a good starting point and a great starting point for change as well.
I have a discussion in mind I had yesterday with one member of our management, and I started to make a few points in this direction, and then he just looked at me and said, you know, that's all right what you're saying, but don't forget, you'll get paid. It was not exactly your words, and I'm not really sure if I get it right, but I understood, like, you get paid, so you probably should think enough and do enough work and be a little bit happy about it because you get paid. So don't complain that much.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how to convince him that just paying money or even more money won't be enough one day. Because at a certain point or a certain amount of money, people will not care about money because it's just a number at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully agree. Like, and that's what I think also the conversation should be about. Like, money, sure, you need to make enough money for you to make it feel fair, to be able to be able to spend your money on the basic needs that you have. But it's not a motivator, as you mentioned, like after a certain amount of money. There's much more value both for people and for the organization in creating meaning, in creating autonomy, and creating a certain kind of purpose for people. So the conversation should be more about that. How can we build that into the organization? And yeah, some people you can convince them with research. So you can gather all kinds of research being done on the topic, showing that it's not just better for you as a person, it's better for you as an organization as well. And others you need to talk more about about feelings. Yes, I'm here also to collect a paycheck, but it's not a transactional thing that I'm looking for here. I'm looking for contributing to something that I truly believe in and using my talents in a way that can also benefit the organization and constantly developing them more and more and more. And for some, a combination of those works. And for others, you can't convince them by just talking. You just have to show it to them. And you have to set up an experiment and just allow them to give you maybe a month time to try something out, to properly measure what you're doing and to show that it's actually also beneficial for that specific person. Because at first, people might be scared of this. Like if an employee comes up to a manager and that manager thinks, oh, he wants more freedom, he wants more to set his own working hours, for example, or that kind of stuff. That can be really scary because they're also not used to working in an environment like that. But if you give it a try, and also if managers see that people are actually performing better when they're having more freedom, if you organize it in the right way, and if they are able to make more decisions themselves, it also is a relief to the manager, who then is not anymore the bottleneck for decision making, for example, or the person who others are always looking up to make decisions when times are tough. And which is also a tough position for managers to be in. So also for them, it kind of changes their role and makes it into, can make it into a more convenient role where they are supporting people to excel, and not so much anymore being the person that everybody depends on.
Let's take probably this person I talked to yesterday and quote some research, probably let him experience in an experiment how this more progressive way of working could look like. And also probably have this discussion about that money isn't enough. I'm still wondering how to make it easy for him to try another way and to leave the organization or this picture of himself and the picture of management behind, which is basically everything you just described. It's like being some kind of bottleneck, which makes you quite important. And if it makes you important, you feel your own person, your own work valued because you can decide. And if you can decide, then people rely on that. And that's somehow of a rewarding work. And if you change the system, they probably, at least in my mind, probably they are scared about that because they lose somehow their very personal purpose of being top of the pyramid and to help people, to lead people, to show the direction, to make the decisions day by day. And probably it's not really a relief not to make these decisions anymore. You know, how can I tell them and show them, hey, don't be scared about that?
Yeah, it's a super valid point that you're sharing. I think this is one of the main reasons why it's so hard for companies to change. And because it depends very strongly on personal change. Like leaders need to let go of some authority and responsibility, and they need to give that over to other people, which is extremely hard. As you mentioned, both in terms of rewards, because as a leader, we're always trained that if you become a manager, you should know more than others. You should be able to make the right decision. And this, for young managers, this feels super uncomfortable at first. To all of a sudden be in a position, well, I have to make decisions now. And they kind of play this game. Okay, now I'm a manager. Now I know. So I listen to you, and I make the right decision. Which is also, I can tell you, very uncomfortable for the people in those positions. But once you get used to that, and it makes you feel important. It makes you feel, like you are one of the most important people in at least that team, or even in an entire organization. It's really hard to then get rid of that. So this is, I think, one of the main blockers of why not more companies are changing. It depends so much on personal change as well. And this is really hard. And I think there's not a single solution to this. It's about showing that it works better for both people. That also, like in the end, if your manager is... Let's say your manager would say something like this. And in the end, that person also wants to do a good job. So the success of what he is achieving should be known to others. That also gives like a rewarding feeling. So if you can show that when you get more authority or when you get more freedom, you do a better job, then this can also be beneficial to that person because of the way he's leading, and this might be another way, and a more open, more progressive way of leading, the team is flourishing and getting better results, which also is good for him personally because other people are seeing what he's doing and that he gets better results than before. And I think you should play into this a little bit. Like, on the one end, I think being a human leader should be a reward in itself. But for the people who are maybe not seeing that yet, it might be interesting to look at, okay, how can we make you more successful as a leader? We can do that maybe by getting more authority to the team. So this might be a way to play into that and to then set up some experiments to give that a try.
Very cool thoughts. Thanks a lot for that. I have three questions for the end. Is there a time when you will return to a corporate and work for a corporate again?
I hope not, because now we're running our own company, trying all of these things in our own organization. And I hope that we'll be able to continue to do that, to grow the impact that we have. So I hope that's not needed. And if so, I think this is an important message as well to other people. If I would be looking for, let's say we go bankrupt, nobody wants our stuff, we're doing a shitty job, so we go out of business. In that case, when I would be looking for a new company, I wouldn't just look at a job, the job itself, like what is the content of the job. I would look much more at what is the culture of the organization, what kind of values do they think is important, what is the way of organizing that they use, because I think this is a very important part of getting a really nice job that you really appreciate and value. So also for people who are looking for new jobs, like finding the balance between liking the job and also enjoying the company culture, I think that's a very important thing to look at to make sure that your next job is more enjoyable than your previous one.
When will Swiss Post become a member of your bucket list?
After you start experimenting. Now, yeah, when you're doing such progressive things that we think it's interesting to research and mostly to share it with the people that we have in our community that are interested to learn from others. So start experimenting.
I already did. A lot of my colleagues already did. So when this whole Corona stuff ends, you're invited to visit us here. And I'll be very glad to show you around and share what we tried so far.
Yeah, great. And I think this is also stories like that are very important. Like people working inside large organizations with a big history that are trying to change things inside out, whether they are successful or maybe running into some challenges along the way. I think it's super important for other people in other big companies to understand too, and to learn from that and to get connected with that. So yeah, happy to visit and to share those stories as well.
Cool. Looking forward to it. At the Espace Lab entrance, there's a place for your quote. Which quote shall it be?
I got one nice one for you, which we finish. I think also it's one of the last pages of our book. Sorry for the inconvenience. We're trying to change the world here.
Sorry for the inconvenience. We try to change the world here. Pim de Moray, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thanks for the nice conversation.